May 1998, I'm at Peter O'Day's house and we're carrying out an interview for the ACT branch of the Labour History Society. Peter, when did you join the union?
I joined the union in about, I guess about 1966.
How old were you then?
20.
What was the union?
The Australian Workers Union. I was a council worker.
And how long did you stay with that union?
Well, about 2 years.
What happened then in terms of your union affiliation?
I joined the liquor trade union because I worked as a barman for 7 years, and then I joined the Builders Labourers Union, and I remained a member of the Builders Labourers Union until, well, late 80s.
Where was those first union affiliations?
My first affiliations were in South Australia.
Were you involved in politics in the AWU?
Only in terms of the depot. I was a candidate for workplace delegate, which is actually why I got the sack in the end. And I did some leaflets about various work issues at the depot, but no, I had no political affiliations at that time.
When did you become an officer of the union first?
1973.
What was the union?
Builders Labourers Union, South Australia.
What was the position?
It was actually called Ombudsman. The union had, as a public relations exercise, decided to investigate complaints by homeowners about shoddy workmanship, and I was taken on to do that.
And what was your career in the Builders Labourers Union after that position?
Well, I didn't stay in that position long. Within 12 months, I was the acting secretary of the branch.
South Australian branch?
South Australian branch of the BLF. There was a federal intervention into the New South Wales branch against Jack Mundy and his group. And the officials from the South Australian branch went up to participate in that, and that's how I got elevated to be acting secretary.
And what was your next position in the Builders Labourers Union?
Well, from when the intervention settled down in 75, I became an organiser then for the South Australian branch, and I came to Canberra as a federal organiser in 1976 as a part of a federal intervention into the ACT branch of the BLF caused by an attempted takeover of our membership here by the Building Workers Industrial Union.
Did you have any political affiliations during that time of the Builders Labourers Federation?
Yeah, about the time I joined the Builders Labourers Federation, I joined the Communist Party Marxist-Leninist.
Did you have any positions in that party, any official positions?
Pariah.
When did you leave the Builders Labourers Federation?
The union was deregistered in 1986, and I continued to try and defend the situation until about 1988, 89.
And did you maintain your political affiliations during this period?
No, I managed to get expelled from the Communist Party Marxist-Leninist in 86.
Why was that?
Largely because of my outspoken criticisms about the negative role that the party had played in events leading her up to the deregistration of the BLF.
Were they spoken or written?
Written.
Where were they written?
There was a booklet put out in 1986 in the ACT called Swimming Against the Tide, the History of the Builders, Labourers and the ACT, and the final sin I made was that a draft of it, which was leaked by someone out of the branch, a draft of it mentioned that most of the federal executive of the BLF were members of the CPAML.
Were you a family man with children during this time?
Yes.
Did the union work affect your family life?
I think my family paid a dreadful price for my union work. To the extent that there were death threats against my children. When I was away on business, my wife would get calls in the middle of the night, someone breathing heavy into the phone, etc. Yeah, we paid a terrible price.
Is that price still filled?
Yes.
You mentioned earlier that you were a workplace delegate before you became an official. Do you think that had any effect on your later career?
Well, I actually didn't get to be a workplace delegate. I tried to. They had a workplace delegate in the council depot who was the original boss's stooge, and there were a group of workers who tried to supplant him with me. But that was quite obviously seen by management fairly quickly and nipped in the bud, and I was let go. But that was my first exposure to that sort of stuff.
And did that sort of stuff have any effect on your industrial activities?
No, I learned some things. I learned some valuable things working at the council. I didn't have much of a union experience when I was a member of the liquor trade union as a barman. That was simply a matter of the boss taking the money out of my pay. I can safely say that in the whole 7 years I was a barman, I never saw anybody associated with the union. It was purely a transaction which the employer organised, and I just paid. My first real exposure to strong trade unionism was the Builders' Labourers' Union. When I got retrenched as a barman, someone got me a job as a builder's labourer, and I was absolutely stunned at the level of organisation that was there.
How did that level of organisation show itself?
Oh, things like regular bulletins, monthly. The most staggering thing for me was monthly general meetings of the membership, which were decision-making meetings and quite powerful. And in fact, there was a huge amount of organising needed to be done because you could never predict the outcome of general meetings. So people were making sure that they had numbers there and that issues were thoroughly debated. But the rank and file could actually pass virtually any proposition they liked.
Did that sort of organisation carry through to the ACT branch of the BLE?
Oh, that's what I attempted to bring here. We set the branch up as a result of a federal intervention in 1976 and became an autonomous branch again in 1977. That particular form of organisation, like monthly general meetings of the membership, which were to be the decision-making body, that carried through. That was standard in all our branches. We had very strong participation of membership here, and obviously it varies. If there was nothing on, we might have meetings in which we only got 12 or 15 people a month, but if there was something on, we might get 60 or 70. And we did that, and we also coupled that with lots of regular stop work meetings on sites to discuss issues and heaps of information, and not just information. We weren't shy about making propaganda. We recognised that the employer makes propaganda, and the union had to do the same thing. It was a battle for hearts and minds.
Before 1986 in the ACT branch of the BLF, was it factionalised?
No.
Afterwards?
Well, after 86, I mean, there was the organisation was placed under intolerable strain when the union was deregistered. It was sort of all the rules were out the window. And that created transitory tensions inside the organisation because we were all thrashing around trying to find a direction out of the trap we were in, and we weren't able to find one, and people had various views about what to do, and the money was going down, and it was just too hard. So there was some minor recriminations about what could have been done or what shouldn't have been done at the time of the deregistration, but quite clearly in hindsight, with the forces that and the level of force that was used against us, there was nothing we could have done anyway.
Did you present matters to the Industrial Relations Commission or the Federal Court during this time as a union official?
Regularly to the Commission, never to the Court. And in fact, you can't to the Federal Court. You have to be legally trained to appear before the Federal Court.
Have you any comments on that that role in the IRC?
Only that it's a different role to what it is now. I quite liked appearing in the commission. I always used to prefer to be dragged into the commission to answer someone else's case than to actually try and get my own off the ground. But the commission was a big feature of my work, and the commissioners in those in that period were not so much like the commissioners I see today. There was a lot more wheeling and dealing, a lot more pragmatism, a lot less legalism.
As a full-time official, what role and responsibilities did you have in determining union policy and practice?
Oh, quite large. I was the secretary of the branch. I was also a member of the federal executive of the union, member of the federal conference of the union, and I would prepare policy positions for the general meeting, and take propositions both to the federal executive and the federal council.
Do you believe that the 13 years of a Labor government was a help or a hindrance to the trade union movement, and in what way was it?
Well, I guess it's one of those things about the road to hell being paved with good intentions. I could take a dogmatic view about the Accord as a communist, but if I was to be a bit more, I suppose, practical about it, then I think the Accord was a device used to justify self-governance of the labour movement, if you like, and to prove that there could be a reliable partnership between the labour movement and the forces of production, the employers and the capitalist class. But it was always doomed, in my opinion. It was always doomed, and unfortunately it disarmed the workers, because that self-reliance ceased, and it's proved very difficult to get it going again now.
What do you believe was the role and result of the ACTU involvement in determining trade union policy and practice?
I think the ACTU was the other half of the Accord with the Labor move, with the Labor government, and they actually fulfilled the function of corralling the unions, and they corralled them not only into abiding by the Accord and not making any claims outside the Accord, which was why the Builders Labourers got trashed anyway, because they were not prepared to abide by the Accord. And secondly, the ACTU played the role of rounding the unions up into larger groupings to deal at a corporate level with the Labor government, e.g. the mega unions, the super unions.
There is a question too about the super unions. I might just jump and come to that, since you've mentioned it. Says the ACTU plan for creation of 20 super unions is now complete. What is your view of this change? Has it fulfilled expectations of applying greater resources, efficiencies into the trade union movement? And what effect has it had on you as a trade union official?
I think the union movement was conned. I don't think the super unions are actually meeting the role that they were intended to do. They have massive bureaucracies. I think they further distance the rank and file from the levers of power in a general sense, and I won't say that that's a universal thing across all the large unions, but as a general proposition. I think that they were also designed to meet what people saw as a lasting era of corporate cooperation between central government and central employer bodies and large unions. And the joke is that no sooner had we gone through all the agony as trade unionists of setting all those mega bodies up, that the other side abandoned all that. We'd built ourselves a huge battle cruiser, and they'd all shifted to fast missile attack boats. And we're trying to deal with that right now.
And in dealing with that right now, can you give some examples?
Well, yes, the unions are being run ragged by the requirement to have virtually awards, certified agreements, which have now gone so far as to actually resemble full awards, in each workplace rather than in an industry or a section of an industry. It's meant that there has been a massive demand on union resources. It's also meant that there is no consistency of approach anymore. It's meant that the relationship between unionists and non-unionists has changed. And it's placed a whole lot of power both in the hands of employers and, to a lesser extent, in the hands of employees not directly related to union structures.
And in your currently, you're associated with the CPSU in Canberra. In your current experience, do you believe the union is handling those pressures well?
No, we're not handling them well at all. I can safely say that the in the last 4 years I've been in the an organiser of the CPSU, we haven't essentially won anything, and in fact we've become quite good at dressing up our defeats in terms of scale and presenting them some of them as victories even. No, I don't think we've done well at all. I think we've been in a period where the public sector's been cut to ribbons, where working conditions are being cut to ribbons. I was at an opening of our national office only 2 days ago, and Kim Beazley made a speech, and I think he had a damn gall, as they say in the movies, a damn gall. He said that he made the analogy that he was opening the union office, he was opening a bunker, and he's predicted that if the Labor government wins the forthcoming federal election, we would move from being in a bunker to being on a balcony. And I just think that's the most utter disingenuous crap I've ever heard. It was the Labor government that took the lid out of the bottle and let the genie out on all the economic rationalism and what's flowed from it in this country. And I don't believe that simply getting them back in power is going to take the unions from bunker to balcony. It's a fallacious argument.
What is the impact of enterprise bargaining on union membership numbers and on methods of organising?
In terms of union membership numbers, I don't think it's made a great deal of difference in the public sector at the moment, because, if the job's done well, there is the opportunity to actually recruit, because it forces, the new Workplace Relations Act forces non-union members to actually participate in industrial processes. And the challenge for us is to show them that should translate into union membership. Problem is, I don't think that a great number of organisers I work with are actually trained or qualified to work like that. The ethos of the mega unions hasn't died. We're trying to apply some new methods about dealing with decentralised wages, but we're still doing it from the psychology of the mega unions, and it doesn't work.
Was there any specific training given to enable union officials to cope with this change of industrial organisation?
None, nil, zilch. In fact, it was close to 6 months after the commencement of the Workplace Relations Act that our organisation was still trying to come to terms with what the meaning of the Act was and what the ramifications for us were. Our organisers per se, and we have 15 of them, are not trained. They're not given any training. You go for an interview, you win a job as an industrial organiser, you may never have done it before. If you win the job, you get a nameplate saying industrial organiser, and you become industrial organiser. And you invent yourself, and everybody does it differently.
Do you think that this decentralised bargaining either enhanced the relationship between the union and its members, or did it result in distancing the two? If so, why and how?
Perhaps I'll start it this way. It should have been able to enhance the relationship between the members, because it made the attack on members much more visible in individual workplaces, and it also stopped that thing about people saying the union hasn't done this or the union did that, because you can directly translate it now to it being the responsibility of people in individual workplaces. Having said that, I don't think we've capitalised on that, and I would think that we've probably strained relationships with quite a lot of members who are not quite sure what the union stands for anymore, given that we've gone from being quite rigid about central control of decisions about what wages and conditions were acceptable for workers in our industry to actually tagging along and accepting a whole raft of things in individual agreements now that we wouldn't have encountered 2 years ago. So, I think we're playing catch-up.
How strong is the delegate structure in the CPSU, and how does it compare with delegate structure in the BLF?
The delegate structure in the CPSU is not strong. 2 years ago, we moved to a new structure in the union, which was moving away from the central office and branch structure to sections where parts of the union were defined in terms of them being an agency. For example, Department of Social Security was a section, a self-contained section, the ABC, the tax office, CSIRO. They would have their own section secretary who would be a full-time official. They would generally, within the broad parameters of the union, run their own affairs. What's happened is, what's happened largely as a result of that is that there's been a redefinition that people see themselves as being members of a union which is confined to their own agency and not an industry. And that lends itself to what the government is doing anyway, in splitting up an industry of being in the public sector to working on particular wages and conditions in a particular agency and being hired and dismissed by that particular agency. Mm. They've turned it into the private sector model. In the BLF, there was, we were very big on solidarity with other workers and with each other. There were endless disputes. I can remember work being stopped on lots of jobs here at Fleece Watkins in the ACT because someone brought back photographs of the safety conditions of a Fleece Watkins site on the Gold Coast. And the bans were put on jobs here until Fleece Watkins agreed to pay a site allowance and clean up their act in Queensland. The delegates supported the liberation struggle in South Africa. They supported the nurses. They organised strike, a full industry strike for the nurses when they were going for a large pay increase in the early 80s. So it's quite different. In my view, it's partly to do with the constituency too. Blue collar workers, if you convince them of your, if you convince them that you're genuine and trustworthy, they will give you a much larger mandate than white collar workers will, who tend to want to spend a lot of time on process and procedure and words, and often, in my opinion, the action gets completely forgotten.
Coming back to negotiating enterprise bargains, what do you think is the level of skill amongst the management negotiators?
Oh, it's not high, but it doesn't need to be. The irony of this is that while we're being told that we have to reinvent the wheel in every agency, the employers are actually engaged in pattern bargaining because there are so many instructions from the central agency, Department of Workplace Relations and Small Business, about things that must or must not be in certified agreements. We're actually in a game that's rigged against us.
Mm. There's a quotation here. It says, "Decentralised bargaining reduced the relevance of the award system." What's your view of this statement?
Well, it was always intended to. We got into this enterprise bargaining under a Labor government, which told us that it was a way of actually getting tinkering around the edges of employment. That you could, if you could be imaginative and find some extra savings, that you could all share in the benefits. But it was actually moving. It was the first step in moving people away from award protection, and that's gone quite a distance now with the awards stripping back and the June 30th deadline only a matter of short time away.
Some people coming in, I might just stop it here.
Yep.
Just resuming the tape and the interview with Peter O'Day. Peter, what do you believe are the reasons behind the declining rates of union membership?
Well, they are declining significantly. There have been some claims that the situation is stabilising. I don't see it. I keep in frequent contact with trade unionists in America, and the numbers are still declining in the US, and I've every reason to believe that will continue here. There's been a lot of navel gazing. There's been a lot of attempts to change the way we do work in the trade union movement. I might say change the way we do work without changing the power equations, which strikes me as being the real answer in the long term. But I have to say, I think the major reason for the decline in trade union membership is probably outside the control of trade unions. I think it probably reflects if you stand back from our society, it probably reflects a devaluation of the worth of relationships between people per se. And I think it's just another indication of alienation of people in general from each other. And I know that sounds very touchy-feely, but I see all the dysfunctional young people around, I see all the rates of unemployment, I see the sense of community that once would have existed in a place like the ACT has gone to a large extent. The values of the marketplace, economic rationalism, all those things are mitigating against union membership. Turning people into shareholders mitigates against union membership. So, and I guess there's also a bit of a sense out there that culturally the unions don't have to offer what they used to. We were also a cultural reflection of our society, and we are becoming increasingly a cultureless society. So yeah, I think that in large measure this is outside of the control of the trade unions at the moment. It requires a quite significant change in some sort of physical circumstances, e.g. the market globally doing something strange, or a breakup of economic blocs, or further wars, as there are likely to be. It requires some significant social change, I think, before something comes back.
If you had a choice, what bargaining system would you prefer to work with, and why?
Well, that's a very difficult question because, unlike my colleagues, I quite like some of the features of the present system. There are some ironies. I've got an agency I've got in mind at the moment where I'm involved in an agency agreement. And there are staff representatives as distinct from union representatives, shop stewards or whatever. And there are four of these people, and three of them are non-unionists and one's are unionists. I'm enjoying working with them immensely. They're behaving like trade unionists in all respect, other than that they're not signed the piece of paper or paying their dues. And I know that's a significant omission. But having said that, it's an entirely refreshing thing. These people, for the first time, are actually taking control of a whole lot of stuff in their workplace. And I get to address meetings of all the staff now, not as distinct from the union members. I find them all very interested and very interesting, and they value my contribution. And in fact, they have on several occasions, when the employer has tried to exclude the union, insisted that the union has to have a central role. How I get them to actually sign cards and pay their dues is another matter, but they certainly see the worth of it. And that's the sort of level of organising I think is worthwhile, where you actually have a dialogue with people. Before, we used to shut ourselves in a room. I've got this agency I'm talking about, there are 80 people, 18 of them are union members. The 18 would never all turn up for a meeting, there might be 9. We'd sit in a room and make decisions in glorious splendour that meant absolutely nothing to anybody, really. And now I've got 80 people in the room who do turn up and who hang on my every word and who are actually taking very thoughtful and principled decisions about issues. So it's a mixed bag. What I do worry about, though, is it's a system which could work well if we place a lot of emphasis on the organising skills of organising. But it's a system which obviously gives the employer a lay down misere if the organisers aren't really top shelf, because the employer then drives the agenda and just simply erodes conditions. Mm. I don't particularly hold with the central thing of the erosion of conditions being the big one. It's what people learn from it all that's the big one. Mm. I don't mind if the employers take things away, as long as people draw all the necessary lessons from that, because if they do, eventually they'll get the will to get it all back.
Last question is, would you be pleased if one of your children were interested in becoming a union official?
I'd be pleased if one of my children was interested in becoming a union member. And I mean, I don't know what to say. It's a great shock. It was a great shock to me. My oldest son is the only one of my three children who's working, and he's been working for about 4 or 5 years now. But neither he nor any of his friends are union members. They don't see the relevance of it. They think it was something that related to another world. My eldest boy was brought up on picket lines and with union people and union talk, but he simply sees it as being something associated with yesterday, and at the same time as being terribly exploited. I know he and his friends are being terribly exploited, but we don't reach them yet. We don't reach them as well as we would have once.
Is there any other comment you'd like to make in relation to the pattern of questions been asked in this interview?
No.
Thanks. Just want to add a few minutes to the tape talking about Peter O'Day's experiences in the Trades and Labour Council. Peter, I think you were elected as president of the TLC in 1979. Do you remember the circumstances of your choosing to go for that position?
Yeah, if you say it was 79, I believe, I can't remember the dates, but I think I'd been vice president for 2 years before that. It wasn't long after I came to the ACT. I think it might have even been in the first year, but certainly the second year I became vice president. I don't entirely remember the circumstances, but the BLs were rejuvenating a lot of the union movement in the ACT, and it was we were essentially welcomed with open arms. Mm. And as at that particular point in time, the BWIU, which is now the CFMEU, the BWIU had considered itself a sufficient force in its own right not to need the Trades and Labour Council. And they weren't even affiliated. They weren't in the game, so it was a greenfield site in some way.
How was the TLC used in political and social activities during this period before deregistration?
Oh, it was a very organic little TLC. It was a bit like the mouse that roared in some ways. It did quite a lot. It wasn't a prescriptive organisation. It didn't play power politics. There was no strident divisions between left and right wing. Propositions were generally dealt with on their merit. Some of them were a little bit loopy on occasions, but the TLC saw its role as promoting struggles and promoting unions, and it actually was quite emphatic about it. Didn't see its role in limiting people. We weren't there to corral people. We weren't there to tell unions their claims were outrageous or needed to be modified. I think that was one of our biggest sins in the 80s. We took the view that we were there to support the affiliates and that that we didn't need to actually draw all the strings together in the way that the ACTU did with the Accord. And in fact, that entirely set the ACT TLC apart from the ACTU and the Labor government, because the attitude was that we supported each other in struggle.
Did it have a wider role in the community over and above industrial, immediate industrial matters?
Yes, it did. There was, Trades and Labour Council was involved in a whole raft of things. It was heavily involved in the anti-apartheid struggle. It was involved in questions of redevelopment of civic vis-a-vis the removal of houses. It supported homeless people, squatters. It supported unemployed people. And in quite substantial ways, there was material support, and there was also political support. There wouldn't have been an ordinary people struggle in the ACT, where a telegram wouldn't have turned up from the Trades and Labour Council congratulating people and promising support. We dealt with lots of residents' association, Ginninderra Creek Residents Association, etc., about green space issues and redevelopment. We dealt with a whole lot of OH&S issues, such as asbestos, big campaigns on asbestos. We dealt with issues about the value of public education. I mean, the Trades and Labour Council was active in heaps of directions, heaps.
Within the TLC, what support was there for this range of activities outside the Builders Labourers Federation?
Well, I think I'd be lying if I said that the Builders Labourers Union was not the engine. It was the engine. There were people happy to be associated with what we did well, who would not have undertaken that of their own initiative. That's the truth of the matter. And in fact, that was the weakness in the end, because when they're, notwithstanding the high esteem we were held in the ACT generally, and in the Trades and Labour Council particularly, when the deregistration came, the national offices of unions just put the weights up on their local officials and local branches, and our support evaporated overnight. But certainly there was no shortage of supporters of the things we did well in the late 70s and early 80s, and there were no shortage of people who tried to emulate it. Wayne Berry getting the fire trucks to barricade Parliament House and try and drive the National Parliament out with all the sirens going, that sort of stuff, locking the Commissioner out of his office for a year and a half. It was that sort of environment that had been created.
What was the Commissioner?
The firefighters didn't like the new Commissioner who'd been appointed and refused to cooperate and locked him out of his office for nearly 2 years, I think, from memory.
Just coming a bit forward to the deregistration of the Bills Labourers Federation, what was the role of the Trades and Labour Council in that dispute?
Its role was that it was unable to protect us, unable to protect the Bills Labourers. It was unable to repay all the contributions the Bills Labourers had made to the trade union movement in the ACT. And it went very quickly from being stridently against the deregistration to accepting it as a fait accompli and making new alliances with the BWIU after it happened. Yeah.
And Charles McDonald went along with that movement, or did he try to hold out?
Charles was a good friend of the BLF for many years. The problem was at the deregistration, and I mean immediately the point of the deregistration, Charles was very good. I can recall he was arrested on the Parliament House site for trespass. I can also recall him making a presentation to the affiliates in the Labor Council describing the BWIU as those grubs across the road and displaying a lot of anger, but he drew his bread and butter from being Secretary of the Trades and Labor Council, and when it was clear that the sufficient force had been used to crush the builders' labourers, in terms of, and it was particularly police force, the deregistration would not have succeeded without the use of massive police force, as similar to what happened to the MUA in some respects. But when that all became obviously a fait accompli, then it all dissolved.
This shift in orientation of the Trades and Labour Council, how has it shown itself since 1986?
Well, it took me a while to recognise the signs, because in 1986 I was not only the Secretary of the Builders Labourers, I was the Secretary of the Furnishing Trades Union, I was also the President of the Trades and Labour Council. And essentially overnight, I became a pariah with a lot of people. In fact, literally there would be trade union officials who were walking down, who had been hail fellow, well met the week before, who would walk down the street and cross the road when they saw me, cross over the other side. So I guess I was cut out of the loop pretty quickly on what was going on. But the thing I had noticed was that there was some rewards given to the Trades and Labour Council. And those rewards were in the form of a quite substantial amount of government funding. Trades and Labour Council received government funding for its Occupational Health and Safety Centre and for some other projects, its trade union training program, etc. So I guess it was welcomed back into the fold, into the Accord fold, and was quite richly rewarded for a while. And those rewards have lasted the best part of a decade before they were weaned off them again. The money's all been taken away again.
And the TLC's activities, its industrial and social role, any comments on that since you ceased being President of the Trades and Labour Council?
Well, I've got to be careful, because I've got to be careful not injecting sour grapes into it, and secondly, I've got to acknowledge that I haven't been close to it for a long time, but it strikes me that it's not in anyone's face. There's not a great deal of controversy surrounding the Trades and Labour Council, and it doesn't have a high profile. I guess the the point I'd make is that just before, well, at the time of the deregistration, the Trades and Labour Council unanimously passed a resolution here in respect of the builders' labourers about the major contribution that they had made to the trade union movement. And I distinctly recall that the resolution included that the Trades and Labour Council was at that point in time more vibrant than it had ever been in its history. And we had positions on community issues, on industrial issues, and we offered pretty well unqualified support to our affiliates in their battles. We didn't criticise people unless they were behaving entirely outrageously. We'd support them and try and help them win their disputes. So I don't see that at the moment. I think the power politics of the move of the ALP into the Trades and Labour Council killed all that.
And the last question, do you think that the introduction of self-government in the ACT has marginalised the role of the TLC in the Territory?
It was designed to do that. I have to say I can chuckle when I sit back and think of occasions. There's a Peter O'Day Builders Labour sitting around the table in Parliament House with six federal government ministers at one stage, all on the other side of the table. And it was over things like the asbestos and over charges against trade unionists at on the asbestos picket lines and the removal of asbestos from Watson High School, etc. In that particular time we'd had people arrested on the picket line, the quite lengthy 16-week picket line at the National Library over asbestos. And people had been charged with offences, including myself, for resisting arrest, etc., obstruction. And as a reprisal, the Trades and Labour Council had stopped the construction of the police AFP computer centre and stopped it for a year and a half. And we ended up sitting around a table with six federal government ministers, at least people who's normally running the nation and dealing with Washington and Moscow or whatever, all sitting there negotiating with us about the dropping of all the charges against the trade unions and the spending of $6 million to take all the asbestos out of two buildings and a raft of other things. And I knew at that particular point that quite apart from the issue of wanting to increase the amount of funding local residents had to pay for the upkeep of the capital, that they weren't going to wear this situation for too much longer.
Thank you.
A glass of single malt whiskey hidden in the bottom drawer, and I don't want to be a bandage if the wound is not mine. Lend me some fresh air. I don't want to be adored for what I merely represent to guilt. I don't want to be a babysitter, you're a very big boy now. I don't want to be a mother, I didn't carry you in my womb for 9 months. Show me the back door. Visiting hours are 9 to 5, and if I show up at 6:10, will I already know that you'll find some way to sneak me in that door? Mind the empty bottle with the holes along the bottom. You see, it's too much to ask for, and I don't want to be your other half, I believe that one and one make two. I don't want to be your food or the light from the fridge on your face at midnight. Hey, what are you hungry for? I don't want to be the glue that holds your pieces together. I don't want to be your idol, see this pedestal is high and I'm afraid of heights. I don't want to be lived through vicarious occasion, please. Open the window. Visiting hours are 9 to 5, and if I show up at 6:10, will I already know that you'll find some way to sneak me in that door? Mind the empty bottle with the holes along the bottom. You see, it's too much to ask for, and I'm not the...
responsible for your fractured heart and its wounded feet. And I don't wanna be a substitute for the smoke you've been inhaling. Well, what do you thank me? What do you thank me for? Visiting hours at 9 to 5, and if I show up at 10 past 6, will I rather than know that you'll find some way to sneak me in and door? You.